The Lyrebirds down in the gully putting on a real show this morning. Welcome to About Regional, a new place for the stories of southeast New South Wales. My name's Ian Campbell. Thanks to my partners in this week's podcast, Light to Light Camps. Pristine beaches, great food, hot showers and comfy beds. This is your chance to explore the wilderness coast south of Eden in real style. Check out lighttolightcamps.com.au. Refugee Week is being marked around the region. The theme is a clever play on words borrowed from our national anthem. With courage, let us all combine. The aim of the week is to celebrate the contribution refugees make to Australian society and to ultimately build a better understanding between different communities and bring about more successful integration. A range of cultural, social and advocacy events are planned in the Yurrabadella, Bega Valley and Snowy Monaro in the coming days, and I'll have details for you shortly. William Maley is Professor of Diplomacy at the Australian National University and Vice President of the Refugee Council of Australia. He's just been in the region as a guest of the Social Justice Advocates of the Sapphire Coast. Bill's book, What is a Refugee?, is a guide to the complex issues that surface whenever refugees are discussed, while also telling the stories of real people, families and individuals who've sought refuge around the globe. Bill came to Marimbula keen to motivate and inform advocacy around the issue, hoping for a more humane approach to refugees from the Australian government and sections of Australian society. He spoke for almost an hour to about 200 people. I've boiled it down to about 17 minutes. I've cleaned the audio up as best I can. There is a little bit of background noise, which I hope doesn't get in your way. Professor William Maley.
My late father many years ago was press secretary to Sir Robert Menzies, which gave me the opportunity to get to know Menzies as well. And he had some views on refugees which are not widely cited, but which he set out in a speech in the House of Representatives in 1949. This is what he had to say about refugee policy, and I think it was adopted by the Liberal Party, and, or the Labor Party for that matter, and used as the basis for approaching refugee issues. We would all be far better off. Refugee policy, Menzies said, must be applied by a sensible administration, neither rigid nor peremptory, but wise, exercising judgment on individual cases, always remembering the basic principle, but always understanding that harsh administration never yet improved any law, but only impaired it, and that notoriously harsh administration raises up to any law hostilities that may someday destroy it. I think that's a very insightful observation, and it's particularly appropriate in this area where one of the things that's shattering is the rigidity of ministers who are from time to time prepared to treat refugees with an appalling lack of sensitivity, essentially, for domestic reasons. But let me conclude with some comments about offshore processing and detention, because I think this is one of the most squalid and pathetic dimensions of refugee policy that we've seen for a very long time. The credit, incidentally, for introducing the principle of indefinite non-reviewable detention of unauthorised arrivals goes to the Keating government, where it sort of slipped through the cabinet on the say-so of the then Immigration Minister, Gerry Hand. And this kind of approach is profoundly offensive to people who care about justice for a number of reasons. Firstly, if one regards liberty as a value of any significance, then deprivation of liberty is intrinsically punitive. In Nazi Germany, the defence that used to be put forward of concentration camps was that they amounted to administrative detention rather than punitive detention. And I was literally horrified some years ago to see an Australian government produce exactly the same claim in argument before the High Court of Australia, that immigration detention was justifiable because it was administrative rather than punitive. Too often people who use these kind of terms have no idea of the history or the genesis. That incidentally also goes for the term economic migrant. That came straight from Nazi Germany. The German regime at that time used the term Wirtschaftsemigranten to refer to Jews seeking to flee Germany after Hitler's policy settings were put in place. Why detention is so often these days put offshore? It would be vastly cheaper, we know from all sorts of statistics from the Australian National Audit Office to run centres in Australia. They're far cheaper, by far, to put people into the community rather than detain them at all. Ultimately, I think the explanation is that governments have looked for ways in which they can put the plight of people who are in detention beyond accountability to the Australian courts. One of the great historical developments in the achievement of liberty and justice in Britain and in other parts of the world was the writ of habeas corpus, which was a legal device to require people held by the state to be brought before courts so that the justice of their detention could actually be determined by people other than the executive. But if you can send people to Nauru, where the rule of law has collapsed, or send them to Papua New Guinea, then you can put them beyond the reach of the Australian courts and expose them instead to the much weaker protections, if protections are available at all, of the judicial systems in those other countries. And in Nauru, the court system is simply another wing of the executive, which in case you wonder why we even bother calling it a court system. There's an old Afghan proverb which says, if you don't like what you see in the mirror, don't break the mirror, break your face. And I think one of the challenges for us as community organisations and as people who are actually concerned with social justice is to identify the ways in which we can metaphorically break the faces of those who have been responsible for the development and the implementation of policies that are designed to institutionalise cruelty and malpractice. Now, often that seems like a daunting challenge in the short run, but many of the great historical reforms that have come about, the end of slavery and the end of children in mines and all sorts of things like that, came about only through prolonged pressure in the face of what was initially majority support. It really doesn't matter whether morally defensible views enjoy majority support or not, except in the realm of politics. But in the realm of ethics, one of the most important things that one can ever do as a human being is find a channel through which one can stand in the face of these kinds of behaviour. So this, in a sense, is the ethic of responsibility, which was outlined centuries ago by Martin Luther when he said, here I stand, I can do no other. And that, I think, is the challenge for us as well. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Bill. It was interesting hearing the words of Robert Menzies, and perhaps the only political lesson that John Howard didn't learn from his political mentor is the very one that you pointed to. And I guess I wanted to pick up with that political reference that you just finished with. How do we make fairness politically sexy again?
One of the things that I think it's important to do is realise that the task is not as daunting as one might think. And I say that for two reasons. Firstly, if you look at the salience of the issue of boats and refugees with the general public in a sophisticated way, you get a different set of images from those that come if you just read polls that are done by the Daily Telegraph. Most newspaper polls on issues like this are meaningless. If you actually do the kind of survey that the Australian National University does at the time that each federal election is held, you discover something very interesting, which is that the big issues that animate voters in Australia are actually not refugees and asylum issues. They're economic management, education and health, which for good reasons matter to voters in their day-to-day lives. And votes and asylum seekers are way down the list and have been for a long period of time. The problem is that the perception of the major parties is that these big issues cancel each other out, that people who are disposed to support the coalition will be animated by issues of economic management, that issues related to health and education then would incline people to vote for the Labor Party, but that issues like refugees and boats are potentially those which will animate swinging voters. And that then leads to an amplification of the issue in the rhetoric of political parties beyond what the issue in fact enjoys at the realm of the general public. If you do a statistical analysis of vital motivation using a technique called multiple regression, what you find is that at the 2013 election, which is the last one for which we have results yet, the issue of votes and refugees was less than one, was worth less than 1% of the vote for the coalition. Less than 1% of the vote. So the first point is, it's not the insuperable, burdensome issue that's impossible for community activists to overcome, and it's important not to lose spirit under those circumstances. I think the other point which is worth bearing in mind is that one day there will be an election in Australia where a party will try to save its skin by using this issue, and it won't succeed in doing so. And that is probably what's required to puncture the conviction of the activists in the major parties at the moment that this is the hot button issue that will automatically win an election for, which of course is why the opposition tends to cringe in fear whenever there's some suggestion that they might adopt a more humane policy. Under those circumstances, it's more important than ever that community groups be relentless in their pressure on members of parliament, but also relentless in using their acquired knowledge to contribute to debates about what a humane and decent refugee policy looks like. And when you have it's often the case that some of the most creative approaches to welcoming refugees to different parts of Australia have not necessarily come from the heights of a Canberra bureaucracy, but they've come from activities that have been undertaken in an incremental and almost experimental fashion by local communities. And phenomena like the refugee welcome zone provide an opportunity for experiences to be shared about what achievements have actually been rendered by communities like the South Island Coast in welcoming people who have different sorts of needs. And one of the things we've learned from those experiences is that many refugees will settle more comfortably and effectively in rural, remote areas where life is much more face-to-face still than is the case in very large cities, which tend to be anonymous places where it's harder for people to build up social capital. So I think keeping one's eye on the opportunity to provide useful services and so on.
Perhaps one more question from me before we hand over the floor for a couple of questions. Given what you've just said, the rallying call to the people in the room, taking on an issue like this is frightening. What would be your advice to the people in this room who are out there doing just that? How do we wrestle with the tension, the anger around this issue?
Look, this is an issue that was very neatly illustrated in the SBS television series about sending people go back where it came from, which put on display some pretty rancid views that were held by people out there. And I think one needs to distinguish between different sorts of views. And in a way, it's not surprising that some people in a community who not necessarily either exposed to refugees in their day-to-day lives or who have been fed a diet of misinformation about refugees by political leaders and some elements of the media will go away with images of refugees as threatening and ready to swamp us and all that kind of thing. Here's a statistic that's worth sharing. If you put everyone who has arrived in Australia by boat in the last 40 years, without authorisation, into the Melbourne Cricket Ground, more than a quarter of the seats will be empty. The numbers that we're talking about are infinitesimally small compared to other routes by which people arriving in Australia. We're simply not talking about large numbers. If you ask people in tabloid newspaper opinion polls how many people are arriving by boat, they have an image 10, 20 times as many people have arrived as in fact have. So sometimes some factual material can be useful. We also know that when people have very firm views, facts don't do much to dispel those views. People simply feel discombobulated by being confronted with facts. We're seeing it on a grand scale in the United States at the moment. And I'm afraid, a sad view which says, let them die of old age and sort of minimise their impact, because some people are not going to change their views. On the other hand, my experience has been that on occasions you meet people who initially have pretty frightening views, but when you then expose them to factual material, and better still, introduce them to refugees who actually can tell the story of what their own experiences involve, it can change the way in which people think. Not always, but sometimes it's worth the effort. And I've encountered people who, having been given some of this kind of material, have shifted in their heads. They don't necessarily shift overnight, or they don't necessarily shift for it. But they are prepared to shift. And that makes advocacy, even at the local level, very important. At the policy level in Canberra, I think the answer is simple. You know, somebody at a dinner party makes an anti-refugee comment, just stand up and walk out. Giving a person information on the way for what you're walking out. Social sanctions like that are very important. That's why people don't make anti-Semitic comments at dinner parties anymore. And there are a whole range of discourses that would have been socially acceptable 50 or 60 years ago in Australia that are no longer socially acceptable. And there are ways in which one can ensure that it's no longer socially acceptable in some circumstances for people to spew out bile about refugees as well.
I like throwing a shoe myself. Over to you for a couple of questions before we indulge in lunch.
Just wanted to ask you if you have information about efficiency of actions against people smuggling in Indonesia.
We hear a lot of talk about winning battles against people smugglers. Okay. It's worth bearing in mind, people smuggling is a global phenomenon. So winning a battle against people smuggling in a particular region normally means that you've displaced the problem to some other part of the world. If the root causes of refugee movement, the threat being limited by ISIS or the Taliban, have not been eliminated, people are still going to flee. And if you succeed in closing off one route of egress, they simply seek another route of egress, which may be even more dangerous. The figures on the number of people who drowned in the Mediterranean in 2015 are pretty scary, but so are the figures on people from Afghanistan who suffocated in shipping containers trying to get out of Afghanistan to the westward route because the perception was that the eastward route in Australia's direction was closed. And Australia at this time was the first country people coming eastward out of Afghanistan would have encountered that was actually a party to the 1951 Convention, therefore owed obligations towards refugees. So very often what is counted as a success in dealing with people smuggling is really just a displacement of the phenomenon from one place to another. And if governments are concerned about people drowning at the hands of people smuggling, there's actually a very easy solution to that, which is to increase the number of resettlement places that wealthy countries have on offer. And then people won't actually have to seek to get directly to a country in order to activate that country's responsibilities under the Refugee Convention. The reason we have people smuggling is a very simple one. It's demand and supply. The UNHCR's estimate in the most recent year was that something like 1.1 million refugees worldwide were in need of urgent resettlement. The number of resettlement places that were made available was just under 100,000. So 9 out of 10 people in urgent need of resettlement had no prospect of being resettled. And there's nothing more predictable under those circumstances than that you will get a black market. Anyone who's done first year economics will be aware of that. And so when governments say that they can deal with this phenomenon, really they're trying to push water up the stick.
William Maley, Professor of Diplomacy at the Australian National University and Vice President of the Refugee Council of Australia. He recently spoke in Marimbula as a guest of the Social Justice Advocates of the Sapphire Coast, and I was happy to take part and facilitate the discussion. Bill's book is called What is a Refugee? As I mentioned, Refugee Week is being marked across southeast New South Wales, and there's a heap of activities you can take part in. At Cooma on Thursday, the 22nd of June, there's a film screening, Constance on the Edge, between 5:30 and 7:30 at the Cooma Multicultural Centre on Mittagang Road. Constance on the Edge follows charismatic Constance, a mother of six, as she confronts her painful past in war-torn Sudan and risks everything in Australia so that her family can thrive. Filmed over 10 years in Wagga Wagga, this documentary is an unflinchingly honest portrayal of one family's resettlement story in regional New South Wales. That's this Thursday in Cooma. The Bega Valley branch of Rural Australians for Refugees has a packed program of movie screenings, dinners and author talks. And on Friday the 23rd of June at 10 o'clock in Littleton Gardens, Bega, there's a rally to raise awareness of refugee welcome zones. You'll find links and more info in the show notes. And in the Yorubadella, locals are invited to join a celebration in Maruya on Saturday morning as the Welcome Scroll visits on its national journey. Now, the Welcome Scroll is 5 metres long, features hand-turned red gum handles and the signatures of representatives from over 140 refugee welcome zones around Australia, including the signature of Yorubadella Mayor Liz Innes. Head to Russ Martin Park between 10 and 12 this Saturday, the 24th of June. There'll be food, live music, and you can check out the Maruya markets at the same time. Southeast New South Wales, busy as always. Thanks for tuning in to About Regional, a new place for the stories of Southeast New South Wales. Your feedback, story ideas and advertising inquiries are welcome. Just flick me an email, hello@aboutregional.com.au. Thanks to my partners in this week's podcast, Light to Light Camps. Pristine beaches, great food, hot showers and comfy beds. This is your chance to explore the wilderness coast in style. Check out lighttolightcamps.com.au. My name's Ian Campbell. See you out and about in Southeast New South Wales.